Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Okay, the word is out. They're gonna talk about the VOD and the silver screen. Kevin and Tom and Joe know all there is to know, from masterpieces to deep fried tacos. And if the movie sucks, you might hear them say, there's no telling where the guys will take you. Get ready for a spoiler. Won't say it twice, cause we already.
Broadcasting from the lush but not lavish studios located in the basement of the O'Keefe Institute for Advanced Film Snarkitude, this is Real Spoilers, episode 617. What did we see? Hillbilly Elegy. There we go.
Which almost sounds kind of offensive.
Oh, well, I guess. I think it's one of those things where, like, you know, you can, if you're one, you can use the H word.
I guess that's fair.
Which is fitting because a lot of them apparently also just like to use H. So
lots of it.
Yes.
Yeah.
So Hillbilly, directed by Ron Howard. So
yeah.
let's go around the virtual table and everyone can introduce themselves.
This is Joe.
This is Kevin.
And this is Tom. Quick shameless plugs. Don't forget, we're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, iHeart, wherever you find your podcasts, you can find us. While you're there, be sure and subscribe so you never miss an episode. And, of course, if you'd be so kind, leave us a rating and review just so the people who come along after you know that it was worth their time and they should check it out. Also, you can find us on Facebook, facebook.com/realspoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group. One of the best things you could do for us that doesn't cost you a dime is share an episode and join the League of Show Sharers just so your like-minded friends and family, although in today's world it seems like we have like-minded friends, but maybe not like-minded families. But so they could, you know, maybe they'll stumble upon it and like it too, and you'll have something to talk about with them whenever we're allowed to see each other in person.
Good luck.
And we actually, this is something new for us. We have free movies to give away. How about that?
I like free movies.
Yeah. Steal my thunder.
And well, we see free movies all the time, Kevin. We're pretty jaded. Oh. So, but the listeners.
That's why
don't
I
get
like
to.
Them.
The listeners don't get to. So this is for a new movie called Game On. This holiday season, Josh Duhamel stars and directs the wild and hilarious, no holds barred comedy Buddy Games, now premiering at home, featuring an all star cast including Dax Shepard, Olivia Munn, Kevin Dillon, James Rodet, and Nick Swarsden. Six lifelong friends reunite for the Buddy Games, an insane competition of absurd physical and mental challenges for a chance to win a $150,000 pot. You can buy or rent Buddy Games today on digital and DVD. It's rated R. It's from Paramount Pictures. So here's what you need to do. If you tweet at us or Facebook at us, is Facebook a verb now?
sure.
You know, so tag us so we know that you're talking to us, and use the hashtag Buddy Games or Buddy Games Movie, we will select, what is it, five winners?
Yep, we have five digital codes to give away for this one.
Why do I feel like we had six digital codes and Kevin's telling us we got five digital codes?
We all of a sudden, well, now we're down to four. What's happening?
Yeah. So We will select five winners. We will select 2.5 from Facebook and 2.5 from Twitter.
You have to share an account for that.
Yes. We're trying to help people make friends. So this is a great way to do it. But so do that. Again, hashtag Buddy Games or Buddy Games Movie, Facebook and Twitter. Tweet at us, and you could win a free flick.
Now, since I am the head of the HR department, among other responsibilities, I want to make sure that we clarify that if they win this challenge, they are not winning a $150,000 pot. That is the plot of the movie.
Correct. Yes.
I don't want anyone coming for their $150,000.
No, you're just getting a movie.
Yes, it's a digital code.
Yes, a digital code for a movie.
Yes, calm down, people. If we had $150,000, we would stop doing the show, divide it three ways, and call
it a day.
So people who were kind enough to share an episode this week are Librarian Cynthia, Chris Falls, Gabriel Lugo, Chris Williams, Aaron Marlowe, Chris Sanders, Heather Sachs, Chris Magic Man, Tammy Sherman Powers, Carl Chris Clarkson, and... every other person is named Chris, so I just want to keep the rhythm.
Oh, I see.
And... Ralph Chris Tribble. So thank you very much for sharing the show. We greatly appreciate it. And if you want to do something that that isn't free that helps us out, you can check us out on Patreon, patreon.com/realspoilers, where for $5 a month you get all sorts of bonus content and you help us out, and that is greatly appreciated. So there's all that. I guess we will now embark upon Hillbilly Elegy.
So before we get into this,
okay,
is it fair to say that Ron Howard is kind of like the Howard Hawks of the current generation of filmmakers?
I mean, I think that that's a fairly apt comparison, although
because he doesn't really have a style.
He doesn't. He's I mean this as a compliment. This does not sound like a compliment.
Right.
I'm a Ron
Howard
fan. He is a craftsman. Right.
Yeah.
He is not an auteur. He is a director as project manager. Like, and so he oversees the production and he gets his movies done. He gets them on time. From everything we can tell, they sound like they are drama free sets. And he is a consummate professional, but he does not shoot a movie in a way where you could pull out a random scene and be like, that's a Ron Howard movie.
Right.
No,
right?
There's no Ron Howard look at all. And,
no.
And he's very competent as a filmmaker and very versatile. But, yeah, I mean, he can go from Solo to Rush to this. I mean,
well, it's almost like, I mean, Solo wasn't even his anyway. Like,
he came
halfway through that production?
Two-thirds from the sound of it. Mm. And I said at the time, like, I think he was a brilliant choice. And I stand by that. I think Solo was a lot of fun.
I agree.
People were just mad about the last movie, and they took it out on Solo. But
sure.
But I thought Solo was a lot of fun, and I thought Ron Howard was a great choice because Ron Howard, as a director, has no ego. And so while you might say that some of the things we're saying, you know, don't sound like compliments, I think that they are because Ron Howard does not... he does not make the movie about him in the way a lot of other directors do.
Right.
Now,
right,
some
right.
directors, you want that, right? Like, you want a Quentin Tarantino movie to be a Quentin Tarantino mm-hmm. movie, and that's okay. You want Scorsese to be Scorsese. Like, that's okay. But, you know, he comes from this other generation of, even though, you know, he's younger than a Scorsese, but I feel like because he started in the industry at such a young age, you know, and people always
got a little bit more seasoning on him.
And he worked with these people
right.
that feel now like they were a million years ago. I mean, people always talk about how he was on the Andy Griffith Show, but like I think people really forget like the dude was in The Music Man with Robert Preston. Like
he was like a kid, right?
A kid. He played Winthrop and he sings Gary, Indiana and. But I mean, as long ago as Andy Griffith can feel, back it up and go to The Music Man, right?
Right.
He started with the tail end of old school Hollywood. Also, don't forget, like he made a movie. I mean, he was in a movie with John Wayne. He co-starred in a movie with John Wayne, and that movie was directed by another kind of like old school director from that era, Don Siegel, who directed the first Dirty Harry movie.
Yeah.
And
oh yeah.
And so, you know, so he grew up in that soup of, you know, for the most part, especially in the Hollywood system, the director's job was to keep the trains running, right? And it wasn't to necessarily put his stamp as an auteur on a film. And so
Do you think he opens a movie, though? Like, again, we go back to the idea of the blank check.
Right.
And I don't think he really got that until Apollo 13.
Right? I think like that Apollo if you 13 see his name, kinda... you know he's competent, though. Like, if you see it's a Ron Howard film, you at least know that you're in for a competent film.
I agree.
I don't know that Ron Howard would be a named director to the average film goer, to the non-film buff, were it not for Andy Griffith Show and Happy Days. Like, I don't know if he didn't have this huge acting career that preceded his move to be a director. I don't know that the average person would really connect his name with the films. And some of that is because he doesn't have this auteur stamp like we've come to expect from directors. And I honestly, I appreciate that because he doesn't get in the way of the movie. His job there is to tell the story and to tell it as effectively as he can and to not, you know, he doesn't like the bells and whistles that scream Ron Howard. Or, you know, and so, and now the problem with that, problems in quotes, is that when the story is less than stellar, there isn't that extra stuff to maybe get it across the finish line.
Brings us to this movie.
And he's run into this before, right? Like, I mean, he's directed a lot of huge movies. But he's directed a lot of misfires too, but I will also say even when they misfire, they're not atrocious. He's like,
mm-mm. Like, so that's kind of how I feel about this.
Like, this movie is not good.
It's fine.
And the problems with this movie live with the screenplay. Now you can put that at his feet at this point in terms of he's a big enough name to where he can take a screenplay and go not good enough. Especially when it's his company now, right? It's Imagine. It has been for years. He can say, you didn't quite get there. Go back and do some more work. But
this movie felt very much like a Lifetime movie.
It felt like a movie that would have felt very important 25 years ago.
That's kind of I kind of settled on, like, it's a good movie, but it does nothing. It's almost like that Jack Ryan flick. We're like, I'm going to forget everything about this. I wasn't mad that I was watching it.
Right.
But in a month, I'm going to completely forget that I saw it.
It's an efficiently made film, and it's watchable. Like, right. Yeah. Like, I was never bored, and I was into the story even when the movie was kind of pissing me off.
Sure.
But which I think speaks volumes, I guess, for Ron Howard ultimately. But I also, like, this movie had the, like, this movie's trying to tell a story about an element of society that typically isn't represented on film, right?
Mm-hmm. Or represented well.
Right.
Like, in a positive light.
Right. So they're trying to tell that story, but as they tell that story, it really comes across as, like, left coast elites telling you what they think this world is like. Even though this is based on a book, this is a true story. The main character of the film wrote the book Hillbilly Elegy, but it sounds like they did take some liberties when transferring it to the screen. Like, I was reading an article, and that the opening scene of the movie, or pretty close to the opening scene, where he's at that dinner to interview for the internship.
Oh, sure, sure.
And he says where he's from, and they're just, like, all kind of making fun of it. And in the book, that's not what happens at all. Like, people, like...
I feel like when he tells that's like, if I were in that, in like that executive's position, and he starts telling that story, I'd be like, you're hired. Right?
Right.
Like, you come out of the squalor and you put yourself through law school. And
in the book, he talks about how his frustration wasn't that they talked down to him. It was like they were so fascinated by this Horatio Alger pull yourself up by your bootstrap story that it's kind of all they wanted to talk about. And that it kind of confirmed this worldview for them of, see, anyone can do it if you just try hard enough, when really he did try hard, but he also kind of threaded a needle to get out of there. And and they didn't recognize all the societal things that were kind of stacked against them. They just saw, see, everyone else is lazy, and if they just weren't lazy like you, they could be sitting at this table with us too. And he was like, pump the brakes. And,
yeah, I think that's fair.
And so, but this goes like the old school, like it's almost like a movie from the 40s, right, where it's just like, ah, these children, they just aren't working hard enough, are they? Like, it's right. And so it's just that's where I say that it feels like a movie from 25 years ago, that it's just like, that's, I don't think that's what people are doing. Because the other thing too is like, this scene in the movie, it takes place like 4 years ago or something. Like, it's, you know,
yeah, right? Yeah, yeah.
This isn't a story about a guy who's, you know, my age, who's 50 now, and he's
like our age.
Yeah, and I might even be a little bit younger.
I think he might be younger, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, and so I'm just like, I mean, they're sitting at that table, and they all got cell phones. I mean, it's smartphones, so it can't be too terribly.
That's
long
fair.
Ago.
That's true. I didn't think about
so
that.
So I just like, yeah, like it's so it and it in an effort to try and talk about this element of society that typically doesn't end up on screen in any sort of positive way. Like, they end up really kind of looking like condescending D-bags.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't think you're wrong at all. It's definitely a part of society that is usually represented like in The Fighter, like what's his name? Christian Bale's character, you know? And that's kind of Amy Adams. Oh, it's funny. Amy Adams is also in The Fighter, isn't
but
she?
Even you're just then, making me think. That's more an East Coast working class.
That's fair.
Where this is like Midwest flyover,
like
country.
Kentucky bluegrass, right. Yeah.
And I mean, they never say it explicitly, but I'll say it for them because I think it's what they're saying. They're saying Trump's America. They're saying Trump voters. I don't even mean to be a dick about that.
Look at a map.
Yeah,
right. Like, look at an electoral map. And
yeah, like they're saying, and so they're trying to be like, this is their attempt to be like, we want to reach out and tell a story about Trump's America, and instead it just comes off as really and kind of insulting.
It comes off as what I don't mean this in a negative way, what a conservative filmmaker would make, right? Like, this guy did work hard and pull himself up from the bootstraps Yale.
But it's a conservative with a lowercase c, not like a political conservative. I think he made a conservative film in a, like, he didn't take chances kind of way. But politically,
oh, interesting.
I feel like this is... because he's trying to like show like here's all the problems that these people struggle with.
Oh, that's
and there is absolute truth to that. But the story's told in a way where it's like every scene's got to check a box, right?
Yeah.
It's like broken home, check. Teen marriage, check. Drug
abuse. That's why it feels like a Lifetime movie.
Parental abuse, check.
This movie is so basic in the way that
you're absolutely right.
It goes through these tropes that you would see on the Lifetime channel or the Hallmark channel or whatnot. And it's like you just said, oh, I came from a broken home and I pulled myself up and I worked hard and
I went to the Marine Corps.
It's not doing or saying anything that we haven't seen before or that really pushes boundaries. And so it just feels like such a basic film.
That's exactly what I told Leanne this morning. She was just, you know, we were talking about it. And that's what I said is like, it's a well-crafted film. It looks good. I think the performances are fine. It's obvious that Glenn Close and Amy Adams were going for some Oscar bait.
They are swinging, fine.
I get it.
They are swinging for the fences.
They are.
And I think those performances, because they're getting roasted a little bit. And I think it's because they gave good performances in a not very good movie. And so they really doubled down on their performances. But the screenplay just wasn't there.
That's the problem, because sometimes when you're watching Glenn Close, and we all know Glenn Close is good, but when she's performing some of those lines and really going all in, like you say, it looks ridiculous.
It's
in
almost
this
comical.
I will say.
The look they gave her at one point, I was like, and starring Glenn Close as Popeye.
Right, that's what I mean. Sometimes the way that she emotes and everything, and you're right, it's because she's going all in, but the script isn't there, and it just doesn't feel right. It doesn't fit with the tone of this Lifetime-esque movie.
Right.
And so it stands out and does come off comical, which is unfortunate because these are great actors.
I will say that when they get to the end and they show pictures of what the grandmother looked like.
Oh, the casting's perfect.
Well,
it is.
You think it's the casting, or you think it's the makeup? I was going to comment about the makeup.
Well,
is that she looks, I mean, like they did a wonderful job.
Sure,
they go hand in hand. But
yes, yeah. I agree.
I mean, you could cast the wrong person, and
they
not
couldn't
have
make
it look
me
right.
look like her.
Right? No, they didn't.
I was going to compare it to Charlize Theron as Eileen Wuornos, but I don't think like she did that to herself. There's definitely some makeup. But
sure.
She pulled like a Christian Bale and got into like the shape of Eileen Wuornos.
She spent 6 months as a streetwalker.
No, yeah, right.
Totally making that. No, she didn't.
We can't back that up. Don't add us.
Are you talking about Meemaw?
No. So yeah, Meemaw. Oh, gross. I mean, maybe.
Easier back then. They didn't have streetlights.
That's true.
Oh,
yeah, you would have to worry about when the lights
installed.
When the lights are down low, you know, you don't know any better. But I did think that the transformation that Glenn Close did to look like the grandma was pretty impressive. But yes, there were moments where I was like, man, is that one eye just going to come flying out of her skull? Because she's trying real hard.
Yeah.
Real hard.
It's
to
just
make
the tone
happen.
Doesn't
this movie
work,
does
right?
The impossible. It made me not attracted to Amy Adams.
I was going to say,
well, I mean,
man.
Don't you remember what she looked like in The Fighter, though?
Yeah,
I mean,
but this is even this
oh,
is
yeah.
way rough.
Yeah, this is like, you know, mom jeans and vests and permed hair, like the whole shebang.
But also like heroin addict.
Yes,
you know, I mean, also she's rough. She looks rough in this movie. Mom jeans. I mean, we've seen Marissa Tomei in mom jeans. That doesn't that doesn't really do anything. it's the haggard appearance, and she's looking rough.
Yeah,
and
you can put Mario Andretti in a Hyundai, and he'll still beat me. You know what I mean? Like there's only so much you can do to tie a stallion down.
And that's also a euphemism for what Tom would do if he met Marissa Tomei.
I would not beat her.
No, not that part.
Oh, okay.
Mario Andretti. Put Mario Andretti in the Hyundai.
Yeah.
Well, like the back of a Volkswagen?
Yeah. Tire down? I might do that. If I had enthusiastic consent.
Well, you must. That's a given. That's a given. Yeah. So, I mean, the movie, like we said, there's the plot does exactly what you think it will do. And I will say at the end, I didn't know which way it was going to go, but I assumed it would go the way that it went. Right, like there's the entire movie, your main character is struggling with staying back in his hometown or going to, you know, live his life the way he's been trying to live it.
Yeah.
So when it gets to the end, you're like, you know, and I think at least two of us, Kevin, I don't want to speak for Kevin, but we know this pattern of behavior from Amy Adams. Right. Like,
yes,
I think a couple of us have lived through a pattern of behavior like that.
Yes.
And that does a number on the victim, right? Like you're almost brainwashed and you don't always do the right thing. So I will give them credit where it's just like, I don't know which way this is going to go. Like I didn't read this guy's story. So I thought that was well done. Other than that, it does exactly what you think it'll do.
I don't think that there are that many twists and turns though.
Not at all. I'm just saying like at the very end. When he has to make a decision to stay or go.
There doesn't have to be twists and turns. Like this movie isn't trying to give you twists
and
turns.
It's trying to
peel back the cover and show you a part of America that you don't typically see, but they show it to you in a way that it doesn't feel like you've really seen anything all that revealing at all. Right.
But it's cliched and predictable throughout the entire thing. And that's what I mean. You don't ever, the whole point is that, you know, flash forward 14 years later and he's out of that lifestyle and he's going to Yale and he's working jobs and working hard and he hasn't been home in a long time. And the only reason he goes home is because his mom, the Amy Adams character, is using heroin and she's OD'd. And so he goes back to see her, but he doesn't even want to. Right. And so,
he's there out of. I mean, his sister basically is begging him to
come
home.
Just this obligation that he feels like he has to, but he's got other stuff going. He's living a different life. He's gotten out of that life. And so, to me, going back there, there was no will he won't he. It's like, no, he's going to be out of there as soon as he can, right? And go back.
Well, I agree with you. Is that that's the way a rational person would look at that. But when you grow up the way he grew up in that pattern of abuse and you are put back into that abuse, which he is immediately, like as soon as he's back at the hospital, it's the same story.
And it's there's a manipulation that's going on there, right? There's a guilt manipulation of like, oh, you ran off and got your new life and you don't care about us anymore. And so it's easy to get sucked into that spiral. And at some point, you know, you got to put the oxygen mask on yourself so you can live to help the next people. And so there's like some misplaced loyalty, right? Because like, you know, at 1.88, and I wish they had drilled down more on this. I think this would have been more an interesting thing to examine. But like the idea where Amy Adams' character is talking to her mom, and she's just like, you know, you didn't do anything to help me. And basically, the mom did the easy thing. The mom would bail her out of these situations, and so she and Amy Adams never really learned that lesson. And so what they think is family loyalty is actually ultimately ends up hampering and disabling these people. And I see these people as like the characters in this movie, just to be clear.
I mean, in all fairness, I mean, you know, you bring
you
a little.
That, you see that happen across all, you know, I mean, what is affluenza if not people bailing their kids out of trouble, right? It's just the effects aren't as typically readily apparent because they've got the means, so it doesn't appear as bad, right?
Right, right.
But so like, you know, a lot of what they think of is loyalty and honor is not working to their advantage in some situations.
No, you're
situations.
Doing more damage than anything.
In certain situations.
In certain
right?
situations.
Yeah, like,
sure.
You know. And I think one of the biggest problems with the movie ultimately is he says early in, like, he loved growing up in Ohio. And
yeah.
It was the best years of his life, blah, blah, blah. How about showing us some of those? Because
yeah, it's really brief, like him in the water, but then
they show him floating in the water
and then
and peacefully, and then he immediately gets the crap kicked out of him.
Right.
And so,
right.
So like, I'm just like, you. There's nothing like the movie kind of undermines its own sense of drama because like, I'm just like, why would you want to go back to this? And we live
right,
in the
right.
Midwest, right? Like, we're, yeah. You know, and we're just like watching this, and I'm like, why would you want to go back there? Like, he said that he liked it growing up, but they never show us one positive memory from his childhood.
No, it's all bad.
It's all bad. And so I'm just like, why does this guy have any affinity? And then the movie ends with, you know, in the coda, or the denouement, like it ends with, you know, oh, and they move back to Ohio. And I'm just like, but why? Like, why would he go back to this world? It was awful.
Yeah, it was not kind to him.
I wasn't a fan of the devices they used for the flashbacks, like the sequence that they would go back and forth to. Like, you're introduced to the kid, and like he's in the lake or whatever that you were referencing, and he gets beat up, and then immediately it flashes forward to like 14 years later, and then he's an adult, and it's basically him. Now that he's out of this life, going to Yale, going to law school, trying to get a summer internship. But then it keeps flashing back to, like you said, every single terrible traumatic memory. And I don't know, the way it bounced back and forth to me, I was following it, but I didn't like the way that it did it.
What didn't you like about it? I feel like that's kind of how we get flashbacks all the time.
I don't know. I guess maybe I either didn't care enough about the character to be like, oh my God, I can't wait to see how he became... You know,
sure.
Something about it, and it's probably the script not being interesting enough, but they didn't give me enough time with him in either one to really care.
Oh, that's fair.
Care about understanding where he came from. So, like, it just, he seemed kind of bland, and they only spent a little bit of time with him. Like, oh, I work three jobs, and now I'm going to do this interview. And then, okay, let me get back to my childhood, you know? And I'm like, okay, but I don't really... care why. I don't know. I had trouble connecting with it and caring about the characters, and I think part of that is the script. I don't think that it's written enough for me to really care about these characters, even though there's some great actors and they're going for it. They're swinging for the fences.
There was only one movie in this movie where I felt like it that felt true. And
was it the one when the grandma decided to go adopt him, basically? Because that was the only scene I really even liked, where she kind of wakes up and realizes that she is responsible for her daughter be yeah. the way well,
I think
she is.
She, yeah, she realizes that if I don't get this kid out of here, he's going to go down the same path as the other
one.
Yeah,
see, I didn't like that part.
Oh, you didn't? Okay. That was the only part I'm like, okay, finally, wake up, you know?
I didn't like how the movie
out of your coma from pneumonia?
And this is a true story, so clearly there was a moment like that, and it worked, but like, I just, from a film-telling device, I just didn't buy that, like, oh, the problem was no one had yelled at him in the right way. Like, right? And so I'm like, that just seems so simplistic of like, oh, if you yell at the child right, then he'll start to do his homework. Trust me.
Yeah.
I yelled at a kid. He did not start to do his homework, right? Like, it's and that kid had every advantage that you would want, you know? And so that part to me, I was just kind of like, you know, I didn't buy it, even though I guess ostensibly it must have happened in one form or another. No, actually, the only part that to me that felt like true and kind of revealing and offensive, but still kind of sweet at the same time, it's literally one line of dialogue. And it's when, and I don't even know the character's name, but when the main character shows Amy Adams a picture of his girlfriend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's just a beat, and she goes, "What is she?
What is she?"
Yeah, I noticed that too.
Yeah, and it's like, and she's not even being douchey about it. She just doesn't know. She's just like, you know, and she says it in a way that is obviously uncool, but
very uncool.
but she like isn't being mean or hateful. It's just not the world she grew up in, and so she's just like, you know, so she doesn't have a polite way to ask like, oh, what is her ethnic background?
Right.
Oh,
well,
let's talk about her heritage.
Seeing as like, where they grew up and everything, there aren't a lot of Indian people in the, you know, area.
And I thought that line was great, and because then the next thing, like, she doesn't say anything bad about the girl or anything.
I picked that up too, because she's like, oh, you should bring her
right.
home.
Right. Yeah. Bring her,
and if it were me, and he's like, you should bring her home, I was like, absolutely not.
Because I was, at first, no. I was like, oh, where are we going? Like, oh, is she going to be awful? But then, like you said, it was genuine, and because, she didn't really know how to handle
it. Because it also says something about the world that he's been living in, right? He's been hiding her from them.
Absolutely.
Because she's not white, and it doesn't know how they're going to react.
Well, then, he also doesn't want to expose her.
I think that's a component, and I think that's what he's telling himself. That he doesn't want to put his girlfriend in this situation, and he's embarrassed about his background. But she clearly knows about his background. We get the whole
syrup. See, I don't think that she does, because when...
I think he's hidden the extreme poverty and the drugs, but, but she knows, in broad strokes, that, you know, that if she goes back to visit his family, it's not going to be, you know, they're not living in McMansion.
You're not staying at the Ritz.
Right. Right. And so...
Yeah. You might have a Ritz cracker.
Especially with the syrup thing, and
which man, they tried real hard to make me give a shit. Sorry, Kevin, about them.
Yeah,
and I just couldn't. It wasn't there.
You
like, and I don't have
a
problem
for you.
It did not. Like, and I thought the girlfriend was really good. I thought the guy was a serviceable actor. I thought he was fine. But
see, the guy was kind of Lifetime-y to me too.
I agree. I totally
agree.
Is he the most offensive? You know, like,
but,
character.
But when you see Amy Adams and Glenn Close acting,
right.
And then you go to the guy who, I mean, he seems like a nice enough guy, and I got what he was trying to do with the character, but his delivery of some of the lines, you were like, oh.
In a lot of ways, that guy, that character, is a spectator in his own story.
Mm-hmm. Like, sure.
He's sitting there, and the action's revolving around him, but he really isn't doing a whole lot to drive the narrative, except for the final decision of what to do with Amy Adams and whether or not
should
to
I
go
stay or should I go?
Interview.
Yeah, I thought the casting of the young JD and then the college
that's pretty good
was really. I thought they looked just like one another. Whatever they did with that casting and the real guy, I think they both looked a lot like the real guy. So hats off to the casting. But I just thought the young one and the old one. I'm like, wow, I would really believe he would grow up to look like that. And
absolutely,
I didn't see they were related or anything. So that was good.
Yeah, the casting was really good. But he seemed like a spectator in his own story And I'm sure.
He's not on the poster. I mean, he's the main character.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, think about it. He's the main character. He's the author of the book that it's adapted from. and the front cover is Amy Adams and Glenn Close.
I guess that makes
doing
sense.
Their thing. Yeah. You know what I mean? It's like
so. Would you say that they're both supporting actresses?
Supporting?
I don't think you could call either one a lead.
Amy's the lead actress. Glenn Close.
You think so?
I would call Glenn Close supporting.
All right.
But you're right. They all are kind of supporting in this movie. That's
kind of what I thought. I feel like they're both when they're on screen together, but then there's like solo screen time. I have to believe is almost identical.
And I was like, so when I was watching this, I was thinking, oh, okay. So when he's grown up, the Meemaw has passed away, so you don't have to get Glenn Close for those scenes.
Right.
Right? Like, so we're only going to see Glenn Close in flashbacks, meaning she didn't have to film that long on the movie. I just kind of was like, okay, she's not in the whole thing. Because, you know, to me, she's on the poster, and I'm thinking, I didn't know this movie, not watching trailers or whatever, I didn't know it was a flashback type thing, right?
Right.
So I'm thinking, oh, we're just going to be in this childhood and with these parents, grandparents. And so it was kind of interesting for me when I saw that device that I wasn't really too fond of how they did it just because I didn't care that much. But but yeah, so you're only seeing her in the flashbacks. And then even then, she's clearly not in them all. Amy Adams maybe is in a little bit more, but they're both kind of just come in and go out because he's like the kid is staying with his mom. And then sometimes they'll be with the grandma. There's certain life events. So, like, yeah. What do they focus on? They focus on their first one is with them leaving. Leaving. And then
they leave Kentucky to move to Ohio.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, see, I took it as they were leaving for the summer because the kid says, why are we always the ones that have to leave first?
I thought you meant, like, leaving with a capital L from the narrative. Yeah, like, it opens with they were visiting for a week or so with relatives back in Kentucky, and now they were packing up to go.
Right, yeah. Right.
And so there's certain life events where I don't want to skip ahead too much, but like there's, because this movie bounces around and then bounces back to his flashback, so it's kind of hard sequentially to figure out where things lie. But a lot of the flashbacks revolve around his mom, so the Amy Adams character, and how she has a lot of issues.
There's
like,
a lot
she
of
has
mental
anger
stuff
issues.
And
she's abusive.
Anger and drug problems.
Yeah, she gets mad, and most of these flashbacks, when she gets mad, she starts hitting people, right?
Right.
So people don't, when people say something she doesn't like, she hits them. When people don't cooperate, and like, this kid is innocent in a lot of it. He's a kid, and he says some dumb things that kids don't quite have the experience to know what to say or not. Like the one when he's in the car, was it after the trading card shop? She brings him to go get trading cards.
Well, I think because you're talking about in the car.
Yeah.
Right. Like in the car when he goes to like runs up to the woman's house. When
after
the cops
they go to the sports card store. And they're buying football cards, and then the mom acts like an idiot, and they get kicked out, and then
they seem like they're doing well. They stole these cards, but the guy was a jerk. Whatever, no big deal. But then doesn't he talk about how the friend calls her something? Isn't that the same scene where then she? Just
I don't
totally,
think it is.
Is it different?
Because I think, yeah, because the scene that I'm thinking in the car.
I thought things went
scene,
bad after the trading card scene, like,
no,
pretty quickly.
No, she's taking him to get trading cards because things were bad. Like,
that's the
that
thing. They're always,
her, like,
things are always
that's
bad.
That's the problem,
this,
is they're always bad.
But the point is, the main point I'm trying to say is that, like, she'll seem fine, like, they're doing okay or whatever, but one person says the wrong thing or does the wrong thing, and this Amy Adams character flies off the hinges. She starts hitting people, she starts yelling people,
yeah.
Get out of my car,
I was
walk
married
home.
To this.
Like just right, it's flip of a like, switch kind of a thing.
Yeah, and, where it's like, you know, like you think you're having a normal conversation and you're not saying anything controversial.
Mm-hmm.
And like, and you don't know where the landmines are buried because like you'll say something that you don't think is crazy or offensive. And next thing you know, you're in the middle of a fight.
Right.
And I would say that my ex-wife came from a similar background. And so... and so like there were large swaths of this movie that I recognized, especially in regards to this character, the Amy Adams character, except for the attractiveness. Yes.
So real quick, when we're talking about flashbacks and stuff, why the hell did they flash back to when the Miwa was a kid for 3 seconds and then never go? Like, what was the point of them flashing back to the grandparents being young?
So I liked what they were trying to do here, but you're right. They should have fleshed that out more because what they were trying to illustrate. So this is generational, right? Each generation
it's a learned behavior
informs the next one, and so everyone's trying to overcome the obstacles that have been put in their place by the previous generation. And if you don't, then kind of spirals down further. And so,
but that flashback was out of place when they go to the grandparents for 2 seconds and de-age them down for one scene.
Well, you don't even, like, they don't even de-age them. They're different actors.
Okay, right. Yeah. But I'm saying the characters, let me flash back and I can imagine my Vima running around, running away from something, whatever, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, okay. And then they never go back to it. They never really spend any time with that, with the grandparents as that young age. It's such a throwaway thing where I get if they executed it better and you saw more of how that informed the behavior that then became the Yam's behavior that then taught him and that he escaped.
Right. They want to point to the mom or to Meemaw. I feel dumb even saying that, but they want to point to Meemaw is saying that, like, well, because of, she was a bad mother, look at what she did to Amy Adams. But at the same time, like, that something happened to her, right? Yeah. Like something happened to her that caused her to raise her daughter this way. And I think ultimately that's the story the movie needs to be telling, is that there was some sort of quirk in the wiring of JD, the main character. I finally remembered his name. There was some sort of quirk in the wiring of JD's head that caused him to figure out how to kind of break this cycle.
But he doesn't. In all fairness, there are moments like at the interview dinner table or when he's talking to the doctor.
He struggles with it. And he does struggle with it. He doesn't always succeed, but ultimately he's breaking this cycle.
He got out.
He got out.
That's the
point.
And
even though he moves back at the end, we learn, you can tell from the pictures, he's moving back to a very different Ohio than the
Cincinnati,
one
Ohio.
Than the one he left, right?
Yeah. I think the more interesting story is his sister. Right? Like, his sister stays behind
because
has her own family.
Yeah, and again they don't really address this except just in there's little moments, but like the sister is who raised him, right?
Yes.
Like,
yes.
The sister is the one that raised this kid ultimately, not the mom. At least in, you know, between the ages of 0 and, you know, 10 or 12, because there's a moment where, like, the mom's like going off the hinges and doing crazy stuff, and like and then what do you see in the background? The sister's making food and she sets a sandwich in front of the kid, and you can see that, like, she's the one who's been holding it together, and then, you know, and then she gets out. I mean, she doesn't get out physically, she still lives in this area, but she definitely, she moves the ball forward. It's just she doesn't get the best-selling, you know, memoir because she doesn't move the ball forward as far as JD does. She finds a decent person to partner with.
Well, it's the same guy. It's the same guy that we see. The same guy that she's been that character dates the entire time.
Yeah, but they build a life together and they have kids. They do. It looks like it can be a little hand to mouth at times, but that he's got a good job and that they're building a more stable life in a way that the people before them maybe hasn't.
She's got terrible luck playing sisters. She was the sister in The Devil All the Time.
Yeah, it's interesting how the Netflix movies use the same, almost
I don't think it's purposeful, but sometimes it does feel like they have a repertoire.
Gal can't catch a break.
That's Haley Bennett is the sister. Yeah. And then there's that scene later that really drives that point home that you guys were talking about, where the Mima character is talking to the sister, and the sister's like, "I should have been there. I should have whatever." And Mima is like, "No, he needs a mother. Not like that's not your responsibility." She feels bad that the sister failed him by not being there enough. But it's like, no, she was trying to escape and get her own life and get out of it.
Right.
And
she's she's constantly like, I'm on the phone or I'm going out with whoever her boy. Like, she was constantly trying to get out of the house.
You can tell that the sister, in a lot of ways, gave up a good chunk of her childhood to raise this kid because Amy Adams couldn't hold her act together.
Mm-hmm. Right. You right.
There are other scenes that show, like, Amy Adams, just how she would be irresponsible, and besides from the anger stuff, like that time at the hospital when she got the roller skates and then she's skating through the hospital,
that was so infuriating,
and the doctors
to watch.
Are like, what are you doing? Call the security. She's like, oh yeah, call security, and she gets fired. Like, she just didn't care about,
well, she was also,
well, she's high as a kite.
Yeah.
Right. But like,
yeah, but and again, I've seen this firsthand. She thinks she's being cute and funny, and everybody else is like, what the hell is wrong with you? Like,
right.
I mean, yeah, like, I can't tell you how many times I was mortified by my ex-wife's actions, where I'm just like, what is wrong
with
you?
What are you doing?
Yeah, and it's between whatever mental illness she has, and then you pour some drugs on top of that, and I'll let you decide whether I'm talking about the movie or my ex-wife. but, you know, like, yeah, you end up in situations like this a lot. And, I mean, you know, my guess is, in the with the football card scene, like, she was, I mean, it doesn't explicitly say it, but she was probably high then too.
Yeah, I think she always was, because
probably at some point.
Yeah.
So that brings up an interesting. So was this a Netflix movie, or was this one that Netflix bought?
Well, you mean, did they produce it, or did they pick?
Or
it
was
this
like made a theatrical thing that went to Netflix because theaters don't exist anymore?
Right. Correct.
So in January of 2019, Netflix won the rights to the film after bidding $45 million on the project. So it sounds like they wanted to adapt the novel.
Yeah.
Okay. I was thinking that this now brings up an interesting point. You know, obviously we've seen Wonder Woman is going day and date with theaters and digital. King Kong
I like how Wonder Woman skirted that, you know.
Oh, yeah.
WB in theaters only. But now it's like, well, it still will be in a theater. Like,
just not only.
They were holding so hard to that, and they were trying to be Tenet. And they're like, yeah, remember what happened back with Tenet?
That's exactly it. Tenet was they're like, never mind.
I mean, and I feel for him because, okay, I get it. That's a big budget movie. That's a blockbuster type theater movie. I totally understand why you would want it to. But also, we're in the middle of a global pandemic. So sometimes you have to get past yourself. And I get that it sucks that it's not always going to be experienced like that. But here's the deal. People aren't going anyway. I mean, for the most part, people aren't going. So if you're going to try to release your movie, they're not going to see it on the big screen anyway. They're going to wait till home video. So why not get it out in front of as many eyes as possible? Like, just the fact that they would not concede to that at all. And then they're like, oh yeah, well, it's going to be in both. So it's still, you know, it's just
neener.
Yeah. It's like, come on, get over yourselves, guys. Again, I get it. But, you know, when in Rome, you kind of have to adapt. And this is just, it's a strange time. And WB seems like they're finally, as you said, Joe, with the Godzilla is WB too. And that's another huge blockbuster.
Like, they have their own service. Just do the Disney thing.
Well, that's what they're doing.
We'll charge $20. $20 for a premium.
HBO Max doesn't have the subscriber base Disney does.
Oh, sure.
And
so
they're
that
trying to build it up. So they're going to start dropping the stuff on HBO Max. And also, HBO Max is 2 to 3 times as expensive as Disney, depending on, you know, how you subscribe. Like Disney, you could do an annual thing and it ends up being $4 or whatever, where HBO Max is $15 a month. So, you know, they've got to give you that value. And so by giving you theatrical films that are these big films and just dropping them on there, you know, you're spending that $15, which is already an investment. So I think it's smart for them to do that. I think we saw how Mulan backfired, and now Soul is going free on Disney Plus on Christmas. So it's smart. I think if they want to promote these streaming services, they have to give people the value, and that's what they're doing. And so only time will tell if they start trying to do the premium model on top of that again.
Yeah.
I just don't know how the business model works in terms of, I mean, we've always wondered this about Netflix, but now that you want to take $200 million movies and that were designed for theatrical release and put them on streaming platforms for $13 a month, like, I just don't know how.
There's no back-end deals.
How that's sustainable long-term.
I feel like that negates a back-end deal, right? Like, there's
you're
nothing.
You're gonna have to start giving you a subscriber.
Like Gal Gadot, if she says, I'll take a back-end on Wonder Woman, and she makes, you know, buku bucks on the first one, but now we're here and there is no back end money to be had.
Well, I'm sure they have to renegotiate contracts. So they expected that movie to come out theatrically, right, and have the run. Like, all that stuff is in their contracts. If they're going to put it on streaming, which will then take a huge chunk of the theatrical away, I'm sure they had to go to the principals and be like, well, okay, we're going to move it here. Your contract's getting bumped from 5 to 15, you know, for the main ones or whatever. They can't just be like, oh, we're not releasing it. Like, that's the problem they're running into with a lot of these streaming changes, was they couldn't just throw theatrical movies into to streaming because they had all these deals set up for residuals or
sure.
back end.
That, so Jesse Ventura did that to Vince McMahon. McMahon was releasing all...
Wow, I don't remember a wrestling corner in a while.
It's been a minute. So yeah, what he would do, they would release... Oh, nice. they would release all of the, like, the old from the, like, 89 to, like, 91, whenever he was there announcing, right? Like, they'd release them on VHS, all of the events, all of, like, the, some of the shows. And Jesse Ventura was like, hey, I'm on all those. Like, that's my voice on all... So he sued Vince McMahon for however much money, because for royalties, because he wasn't getting royalties from those VHS tapes. He wins, and then Vince McMahon fires Jesse Ventura. Like, that's kind of the way that worked. But surprising. It was just like that. But to that point, though, like, that's, he was doing that before, right? Like, every VHS tape that was being sold, that was all going to the WWF at the time, and Jesse Ventura was seeing none of that money, and he was like, no. Like, I'm front and center on all of those tapes. Pay me my residuals.
I mean, it's interesting. It's very, very similar to like the, what was it, the Superman thing, or like the whole you know, we're
filming
gonna use
two
your,
at the same time.
We're going to use your footage, in a different movie.
Oh,
you know,
that,
but you only got
Back
paid
to the
for
Future.
Back,
and
you
future,
only got paid
yeah.
for one movie. Yeah, exactly. It's that same thing where it's like, if you're signing up for this pay per view, whatever, fine. But now you're releasing it on home video, and you're selling a whole different, you know, that gets into a different release, and so.
At $30 to $40 a pop in the '80s, like
it's very complicated, and that's why it's this new landscape is so complicated for them to navigate. Because again, they're setting up for a like they have a certain schedule in mind. They're going to do theatrical, then they're going to do streaming, then they're going to do home video, and so when things shift, they can't just be like everyone's like, just release it. Well, they can't just release it.
Right. There's a little bit of work involved
going forward. They may, I mean, as things change, those will start being built into the contract, you know, the streaming thing, or maybe they'll even have a clause in there like, if this skips theaters, you know, if it goes to theaters, this, if it skips theaters, you get paid X, right? Like, they may start building
those
scenarios
interesting.
In.
Did, like, yeah, two different tiers of residuals. Yeah, I mean, and then you hear reports that MGM wanted $800 million for the new Bond flick. And it's like, what streaming company could have? I mean, maybe
Apple.
Netflix. That's true.
Apple could. And I think you'll find movies like that in the short term being able to broker those sorts of deals, because these streaming networks can see it as a loss leader to prop up subscriptions or to try and jumpstart subscriptions. I think that's what you're seeing with Wonder Woman. HBO Max is a good service with lots of quality entertainment.
Yeah.
But they really dropped the ball when it came to marketing this thing out of the gate, and it was massively mishandled and a comically so practically.
I gotta tell you, it's a terrible name.
It's a terrible name. People
it's
don't understand
name.
It. People didn't
but
understand
the confusion.
The difference between HBO Go, HBO Online, HBO Max.
Right.
You know, like it was.
I'll tell
so
you
confusing.
One thing. I mean, we're in this industry, you know, and we talk movies and streaming and all this stuff. When it came out, I thought HBO Max was a partnership with Cinemax. I thought you got HBO.
Really?
I thought you got HBO and Cinemax. Because I'm like, well, what the hell is HBO Max? You know what I mean? Like, I thought it was a
why not?
A
why not call it? I'm gonna.
I thought HBO Max was a partnership with the sanitary napkin. And so, but that's HBO
why not
Max-y.
Call it the? Yeah. Change your colors to gold and blue, and call it the water tower. Right, like,
yeah,
I mean, you know, Peacock is like, okay, it's
yeah, but those,
HBO.
Yeah, those are dumb, though.
HBO is very branded. And so, like, I mean, yeah. I agree. Wanted to utilize that. But the other problem, too, is like, especially initially, it was like, how do you even get it? It was so weird. Like, I was subscribing to HBO through Amazon Prime, but that was not going to become HBO Max. And so I had to get HBO Max. I had to unsubscribe to HBO so I could go resubscribe to it through a different platform. Like, that what? And then I think now it does work on Prime.
It just yeah. showed up like a week ago.
I'm like,
Prime.
It was ridiculous. Like I'm like, why it was and like you were saying, Kevin. Like we do this. I won't say for a living, but for a very advanced hobby, and we couldn't figure it out. And I'm in marketing.
Well, this is the time too when it came out. Remember that HBO Now and HBO Go.
That's the other one. HBO Now. Yeah.
And so it was just so stupid the way that you had HBO through your provider. You had HBO Go. If you had a cable provider, you could stream it there. If you didn't have a cable provider, you'd subscribe to HBO Now. Then they came out with HBO Max while still Go and Now exist, and HBO on Prime and your cable providers.
Yeah.
It's like, no, what they needed to do, what they should have done, and I know it still probably has contracts and all that back-end stuff that prohibited them, but they should have then waited or figured it out and had like, okay, if you have HBO, you have HBO Max or whatever they call it. Have it. Don't make it so that this one has this service and this has this. Like, it was a terrible idea from the beginning. And I agree, like, with what Tom said about the content and the offerings and the way the app works and everything. Like, I think it's one of the best streaming providers out there. Like, the content
is
excellent.
I was flipping through it last night, and
It's
intense.
TV and film, and they tie in a lot of other companies.
Original products?
Not just WB stuff. They have.
I don't think the average consumer really gets it. They still think it's HBO. It's like, I get all the HBO stuff. They don't get how much is on there, which is why I think they're choosing to release Wonder Woman this way, is because they want people to get pulled in and see how good it is.
Right.
And so I think Apple, because they have like literally all the money in the world, right?
Mm-hmm. Right,
and
right.
So like Apple could throw $800 million at a James Bond, because I think Apple's having a similar problem with getting people to watch Apple TV.
I have not watched a single thing on Apple TV.
I never watch it.
Crystal just switched to iPhone, so I think we have it. We haven't even tried
to watch it. You get it for a year.
It.
Yeah, you get it for a year when you get the new iPhone. Like, I have an Apple TV, and I've gotten it with the iPad and a new phone, like to give you a year service or whatever. And I've heard there's good shows like that Ted Lasso, but I don't know what it is. Something about it. It's just really hard to, you know, I'll put on Netflix or HBO or Hulu before I'll put on Apple TV. It's just, I don't know what the stuff, I think for a long time, it's because they didn't have an app on anything else. If you remember, you had to watch Apple TV on an Apple TV. That's how it used to be.
Right.
And so finally, like the Roku now I see has Apple TV built into it, which is cool.
My Samsung TV does.
Okay, yeah. So I think it's just programming people, right? Like, we have so many service providers now and so many different streaming platforms. It's going to take people a while to learn that, hey, you can flip over to Apple.
And so back to the James Bond thing, I think, like, that could benefit Apple. Like, they wouldn't actually be able to show a profit, but if it gets people into their ecosystem, if it gets them subscribing or even logging into a subscription that they already have that they haven't bothered to even attempt to utilize, like I would for James Bond. I'm like, okay, let's figure out how Apple TV works.
Yeah, I'd figure that out for James Bond.
And I'm not even a James Bond fan, and I would do it, you know? But so it would probably ultimately be beneficial for Apple to throw $800 million at something like that. And those James Bond movies make so much money worldwide.
Lots of money.
That, like, I get why they'd be like, no. If you're going to do it, it's going to be a payday.
No, it has to. Yeah. And the other thing is, too, do you guys realize how much Apple's worth right now?
No.
Just guess the company how much Apple's valued at.
I'll let Tom go first.
I'm going to say.
So we can't say $1.
Yeah, $1. I'm going to start with $1, assuming you're still going to win. I'm going to say, like $300 billion.
Okay,
yeah,
Joe?
I was going like $200 billion.
Okay. 2 years ago, Apple finally reached $1 trillion.
Golly.
In 2020, 2 years later, it took 42 years to get them to $1 trillion in 2018. In 2020, they were $2 trillion.
Wow.
Trillion.
Jesus.
So
$800 million
is
ain't
not
nothing.
Right.
Now
Google, how much cash on hand does Apple have?
I mean, I know it's the most cash rich company.
They have more cash on hand than the U.S. government.
Apple cash value. Let's see. But the point is also when you buy an $800 million movie, that's also a write-off. They're not spending.
For sure.
The company's worth $2 trillion, and then they write off on their taxes an $800 million expense. It's not costing them. It's probably costing them $150 million of cash, right? Because their taxes are so high.
But they don't pay taxes anyway. Google how much?
What are you talking about?
Google how much tax Apple paid.
Well, that's my point though. Is I mean, I'm just saying.
On January,
they're in that tax bracket, and then they've got so many expenses. Yeah. So it doesn't matter at this point for them. They can buy an $800 million movie, and like you said, it's just going to generate them subscribers. It's marketing, and they're not paying for it anyway. I found an article that's semi-recent, July 30th of 2020 on CNBC. They now have $193 billion in cash. So what you thought their company was worth is their cash in the bank.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that's a good point.
Yeah. They're worth 10 times the cash they have in the bank. And the cash in the bank is more than any other company in the U.S.
That's bonkers.
So.
Yeah, it's insane. And I knew it would be crazy high because I felt like I was going high even then. But I know that like obviously by default know a lot about Peloton. And and like Peloton's, I think, valued at like $40 billion right now. So I'm like, Peloton's worth $40 billion, what's Apple worth? You know,
that's insane. Yeah, it's so
you can tell how much we liked this movie.
Oh, there's just like we said, it's very paint by the numbers. I mean, here's the deal. So we didn't really run through the plot, but he gets out of his crazy upbringing, and he's, like I said, he was interviewing for a law firm internship. He goes to Yale, and he flashbacks, and you see how terrible his life is, and his mother's abusive, you know, she has the drug problems and all that, and so he escapes from that life. I mean, it just keeps flashing back to how terrible she is. She gets a heroin overdose. He has to go back home and see her. He realizes why he left, and you know, there's some nice moments that they get into eventually as he helps his mom, and he ends up moving.
Then he
back
has to decide if he's going to help his mom or go to the interview, and he decides to go to the interview.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the story, but the moments are very paint by numbers, and like we said, it's predictable. It's not like you haven't seen it. And the story is interesting enough, and I'm sure the memoir is really interesting, but the movie, the main problem again was the script and how it didn't really pull you in and care about the characters. And so even with great actors, the script was so ho-hum that you just didn't really feel anything for them. So his overcoming this adversity and getting out of this life, which, yes, it's terrible. His upbringing was horrible, and you feel for him. But I didn't really connect in a way that they wanted me to, and that was the main downfall. And you've got a competent filmmaker in Ron Howard, competent actors, I mean, more than competent actors. And, it was just okay.
Yeah, it kind of came off as being a little condescending, and it's one of those movies that thinks it's being more profound than it actually is.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Right. I totally. And like I said, it was a fine movie. It was an airport novel of a movie that I'll never remember. It was not as offensive as New Mutants. You know, I didn't get angry while I was watching it.
That's
because you care more about mutants than you do about hillbillies.
That's also true. Yeah. I am more invested in mutants at this point.
So I guess that's Hillbilly Elegy. Like, there's really not a whole lot else to talk about.
Elegy?
It's like about the death of something.
Is it a eulogy?
I kept thinking it was Hillbilly Eulogy, and then I'm like, oh, elegy. What's an elegy? That's what I got confused with too.
Well, a eulogy is spelled with a U, isn't it?
Yes.
Well, no, right. That's what I mean. But a eulogy is what you give at a funeral. And I thought that it was like, oh, Hillbilly Eulogy.
A poem or serious reflection, typically a lament for the dead. I was thinking it was a song, but I knew that didn't sound right. But yeah, it's something you write for someone who's dead. So it's basically, I think it's supposed to be like Hillbilly Elegy. It's like this is kind of the demise of hillbillies in general. Like, this is what they, because he talks about how, like, he's a distant relative to the Hatfield-McCoy feud, and that, like, this is kind of what's come out of hillbillies, and that, like, it's they're no longer hillbillies, but this is kind of what's left of what it's turned into. You know?
Well, it's interesting. Even the Meemaw says, we're hill people.
Yeah.
I just thought that was
all I could think of is there's a line in the Simpsons where
Cletus?
Where Lisa says,
oh.
Lisa's talking to the doctor, and he says something, and she's, I forget what he says, and she corrects him like from a PC standpoint, and she's like, well, they preferred to be called, and he's
it is a Halloween special,
yeah,
and they're talking of, I believe they prefer to be called conjoined twins,
yeah.
And
when Bart has the one yeah. attached to him,
and then, yes, and then the doctor is like, well, hillbillies preferred to be called people of the land, but it's not going to happen.
Oh man,
that's a great episode.
Let's just talk about Simpsons.
Yeah,
done.
but yeah. So I mean, I think it's just kind of the demise of that world, and this is kind of the remnants of it. You know.
So do you read an elegy at a eulogy?
That's too much.
I don't.
I mean, I guess you would. Though.
I mean, I guess you could.
You could.
But but he even says here, elegy is sometimes confused with eulogy.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess if you wanted to write a poem and read mm-hmm. it at someone's funeral, then you've technically composed an elegy.
Same.
But I think most eulogies are in prose.
Yeah.
So, that's how I wrote mine. So,
yeah.
So it's just, you know, more. It's more artsy to call it an elegy.
Oh, I see. So well,
he's fancy.
It's high art. Yeah.
And I think he's also, it's, you know, it's the juxtaposition of the two terms, right? Elegy is something that, you know, it's based in Greek and Roman poetry, and it's very fancy, and then you put hillbilly in front of it, and it's like, it's a good title, I think.
Yeah.
You know? I like it, the two words together, like, it's incongruent, so, like, I like that.
I like it, but the fact that probably most people don't know what an elegy is, as I didn't understand. I mean, again, like I know what a eulogy is, but I didn't understand that this was a poem written about the dead or whatnot. So I don't think that 90% of the people watching this on Netflix are going to even understand what the title means. And so that's why it's kind of like
the words are so similar, both in visual appearance and meaning, that I bet you a lot of people just their mind flips the word elegy to eulogy.
Mm-hmm.
That's what mine did.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, so I mean, because I, until I really looked at it, I wasn't thinking about it, but I was just like, oh, it's not eulogy. What is that word?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So.
There you go.
Anyway, I guess that's it for this one. Do we have any idea what we're going to do next week?
No.
Thanks for clearing that up.
All right.
There's, cool. I mean, there's that's the thing. Things are rapidly changing. There's a lot of streaming content as we're not going to the theaters at the moment. So, there's a smorgasbord of options for us.
Well, I don't think we can go to smorgasbords anymore because of the.
No, Rona. I don't think we're going to go to. Well,
it's a virtual smorgasbord.
Not in your best interest to do it beforehand anyway.
E-smorgasbord.
So, anyway, I guess that's it for this one. Let's go around the virtual table and everyone can say where to find them.
This is Joe. You can follow me on the Twitter at JoeyButts, BUTTS21.
This is Kevin. Follow me on Twitter at KevinRBracket.
And this is Tom. You can follow me on Twitter at Roger Kubert or on Facebook at Facebook.com/Tom O'Keefe. If you want to find the show online, Facebook.com/Real Spoilers. While you're there, like the page, join the group, and of course, check out our Patreon at Patreon.com/Real Spoilers. So that's it for this one. As you heard, we have no idea what we're doing next time, but we will do something. So be sure and come back. Thanks for tuning in. And until next time, Lewis kills the rapist.
Get ready for a spoiler. Won't say it twice, cause we already warned ya. Better watch out, it's gonna ruin the plot. Real spoilers. Real spoilers. Real spoilers.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.